Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Linden. My guest today is Professor William Cook. Bill is a writer, an author. He's a professor of history at the University of La Verne in California. He has written a number of books, and we'll talk about his most recent one. It's called Decades of Deceit, 2002 to 2012. It focuses on, my goodness, Israel-Palestine, occupied Palestine. It's a topic that absolutely obsesses me. I write so much about what's going on. Bill, I welcome you, and I put out a new article this morning. I called it Obama versus Netanyahu.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. I want to talk about the book, not my article, but there seems to be a bit of a rift going on between these two guys. As far as I'm concerned, I hope they beat each other to a pulp.
Would you mind if I were to begin this with an article that I have just written? To a great extent, it would be the first time presented here on your show. It's 2 pages long. It is not long, but it deals with the very issue that you have written about yourself today, and then go directly to your preface in Decade of Deceit and issues that you raise that I want to get further discussed.
Oh, absolutely, Bill. I just mentioned it. It's a mini marathon day for me. I don't know what's coming up after this program, but I literally just finished almost a 30-minute interview on Press TV. They called me about an hour ago. They wanted me to talk about the violence because of the anti-Muslim hate film, but that's another issue, and we talked about that. And I got about they had other comments and intro and wrap up of the program, but I got a good 20 minutes. So that was wonderful. Then I segued right into this program, and we stay right in the Middle East. But absolutely, talk about your article.
Okay, well, this is called The Wind and the Sun. Aesop tells the story of the north wind and the sun. Who is the stronger? They chose a traveler to test their strength. Which of the two could force him to remove his cloak? The north wind went first, whirling furiously down on the traveler, whipping his cloak to wrest it from him. But the more furiously he whirled, the more securely the man wrapped himself in his cloak. The sun abided his time and smiled gently at the traveler, gradually warming the air and surrounding the traveler with warmth and gentleness. Before he had gone many steps, he was glad to throw off his cloak and walk lightly clad among his brethren. The moral? Aesop always has a moral. Persuasion is better than force. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday said the United States had forfeited its moral right to stop Israel taking action against Iran's nuclear program because it had refused to be firm with Tehran itself. Curiously, and perhaps ironically, Netanyahu claimed, "The world tells Israel, wait, there's still time." And I say, wait for what? Wait until when? And the world might well respond, when Israel decides to join the world community in a nuclear non-proliferation agreement and place itself in the same position as all Mideastern states bereft of weapons of mass destruction, standing with all other nations as free states, free of its military totalitarianism, free to join its neighbors beyond the walls of isolation it has erected to maintain its tribal nature, living in constant fear of its true Mideastern lineage. It might find that the communities of the world would find Israel's willingness to abide by international law and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights justification to join that state as a friend worthy of worldwide acceptance into the United Nations, not a rogue state sustained by the impunity provided by the unequivocal backing of the U.S. What moral high right does Netanyahu refer to when his state has been operating without morals for 63 years? How strange, yet frighteningly real it is that a person's life can be tracked by madness inflicted by one on utter strangers or on innocents made enemies to further the madness. When I was 4, Mahatma Gandhi penned this note, quote, It is quite clear that you are today the one person in the world who can prevent a war which may reduce humanity to the savage stage. Must you pay the price for an object, however worthy it may appear to you? Will you listen to the appeal of one who has celibately shunned the method of war, not without considerable success? End quote. That was a letter to Herr Hitler in 1939. Today there is no Gandhi to pen such a note to Mr. Netanyahu as he thrashes about to launch an invasion against his perceived enemy, the state of Iran. His madness is manifest in his deafness to his own contradictions. His moral right to destroy the industrial development of a sister state, his moral right to impose his judgment and his will on the citizens of that state who have done nothing to the citizens of Israel, his moral right to impose his sickness on his fellow Jews, despite their pleadings that he does not speak for them, his moral determination that his state has moral rights to the very weapons he denied to his neighbors, his moral contempt for the perspectives of Russia and China and Brazil and 117 other nations that declared their objection to his idiocy at the NAM conference held just 2 weeks ago in Tehran. And perhaps, most glaringly to a citizen of the U.S., his moral condemnation of the President of the United States, who has groveled with the best of our congressional horde before the altar of AIPAC to declare unequivocal allegiance to this state that has no loyalty to its golem, just scorn for its weakness, its lack of self-esteem, and its acceptance of the disgraceful humiliation showered on it by that very state. That is the madness of one who has crowned himself with glory, lifted himself to the pinnacle of self-righteous power, bathed in the adulations of the fanatical hordes that chant his praises in the House of Representatives, and praised the evangelical Zionists that bow before him as they urge him to fulfill the Armageddon promised their sick minds in the Book of Revelation. How sad. Centuries ago, over 2,500 to be precise, Aesop penned fables, brief but telling tales of the human condition, told in simple narratives easily understood, even by the least of our intellectual brethren, even by an idiot, that conveyed a moral. The tale of the North Wind and the Sun, the one that began this piece, conveys a simple reality of human history. The future of humankind depends on its kindness to all, its sensitiveness to the plight of others, its desire to aid those in distress, its awareness of the thinking that binds people together, and a corresponding awareness to tolerate divergent thought. Its hope and dreams for all who live and all who will inherit this earth, its absolute commitment to compassion, to caring, to sharing, that all may live and love and know they too are equal to all others, bound in loving kindness that all may dream and live in peace. This is a moral Netanyahu might consider as he thumps his way from podium to podium, damning the Iranians, damning those who will not follow his madness, proclaiming his God-given right to blast the Iranians from the face of the earth, to slaughter their soldiers, destroy their villages and towns, turn their rivers into streams of flowing blood, slaughtering their people because they dare to oppose his rule as though he ruled the earth, even though he is a prime minister of 6 million in a state the size of Rhode Island. But of such importance, it must be the voice of all, or so he believes. If it were not that the congressmen of this nation, the United States, might listen to his madness, this might be laughable, but that's not the case. So, instead, what if the Israeli state were to take the high moral road built on true morals, to love one another, to love even your enemy, to love as you would be loved, to sit down with the Iranian people, to meet them as equals, to attempt to comprehend how two divergent peoples held at bay these many decades could understand each other, to negotiate an end to verbal hostilities, and through dialogue and warmth and gentleness embrace each other that all might live to enjoy today and tomorrow and forever together. Thus might the creative and constructive power of persuasion from both sides overcome the derisive anger and destructive power of force. May we let our ancient ancestors speak for us in lieu of Gandhi.
Bill, that is a very, very powerful article. I wish everybody could read it. I'm delighted, and I think it was important that you read it on air. I'm very, very moved by that article. It says so much. It is power-packed, and it has powerful information on it that resonates so much. And anybody like you and myself and regular listeners to this program who are aware of the harm that Israel does, not only throughout the Middle East, but way beyond the Middle East, and the stranglehold, along with the Israeli lobby, it has on the U.S. Congress, where they literally salaam to Israel and Netanyahu and its government and so on. And Netanyahu comes over here and speaks to the Congress, and my God, I mean, this madman, this world-class thug, and they give him a standing ovation about once every 10 seconds. I mean, it is an absolute disgusting display. I can't think of adjectives strong enough to explain it. But Israel is a menace. They need to be exposed for what they are.
That brings us, Steve, to the preface that you wrote for Decade of Deceit, which is perhaps the most compressed rendering review of what has happened in Palestine that I've seen. And it's done with a peppering structure of sentences, one item after the next, until you realize, my God, does it never end? There's a sentence that you write in that preface. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the longest unresolved one of our time. And you point out that Israel pursues a greater Jewish state. And then in Section 7, Koval's, you refer to this, Koval's book, Overcoming Zionism. Zionism seeks the restoration of tribalism in the guise of a modern, highly industrialized and aggressive state. Those are insightful comments, and let's talk a little bit about that, because I think that is what we're seeing in the streets of 20 nations in the Northern Africa, in the Mid East, and in Southeast Asia, as the people react not just to a pretty sick movie, but to the reality that they can voice their reaction to 50, 60 years of incredible dominance by the West, the U.S., the U.K., France, Israel, in the affairs of their people and control them until it becomes too fierce for them to try to maintain their love relationship with dictators.
Well, that's so true, Bill. And the film was just a spark. Whatever was behind it, whoever was behind it, I wrote an article about it. I have my strong suspicions, but I don't have smoking gun evidence. But the film was a spark. It came out time with 9/11, but it would have been the same issue, whether it came out earlier or later. People are angry, and people throughout the Muslim world, far away from the Middle East, in Indonesia, in African countries, these people know more about what's going on, what America and the West are doing to Muslim people, what's going on in Palestine. And most Americans, I must say, Bill, very sadly, most American Jews, members of my own family, boyhood friends of mine, two of them especially, very intelligent guys. They have a brain in their heads. I don't want to say what their professions are, but they're professionals. I believe they're both retired or semi-retired now. They're both my age, and they literally don't have a clue about what's going on in Palestine, and they've berated me in the past about the things that I've said, and the only retort I can come back at them with is, well, find out the facts. I mean, they're all there for anybody to learn. I've learned them. I don't talk about things that I think are false. I get the facts. I state them as I know them. I don't think Jews are special people. I think everybody is equally special, and if somebody commits a crime or any wrongdoing, I think it's fair game, and it's an obligation to point it out. So I call the Nakba, I say the Nakba, the 1947-48, mm-hmm. the war, I say it never ended, and indeed it never ended. And it really began before 1947-48. Two future prime ministers of Israel, Bill, as you know, Yitzhak Shamir, who died in recent weeks, and Menachem Begin, who died some time ago, they were both terrorists. They belonged to terror gangs, the kind of people America wages its so-called war on terror against. And that's what these people did. One of them, I forget which one, either Agun or the other one, blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, I believe, and killed many Brits and I think some Jews and other people. I mean, they blew up the hotel. And even the New York Times was very angry about that in an article it wrote. But, you know, that was before 1948. I think it was 47. And you don't hear the New York Times talk about Israel that way today. But this stuff goes on. It affects Palestinian lives every single day. Gaza is literally, it's an open-air prison, invaded regularly. But the West Bank is invaded as well. Imagine living in a community or a neighborhood, Bill, and from day to day, you don't know whether the Israeli military is going to show up in the middle of the night, break down your door, ransack your home, arrest the father, the son, anybody, just haul them away. It doesn't matter whether they did anything or they didn't do anything. They probably did nothing whatsoever. They put them in detention. They torture them. I mean, this literally goes on every day. I follow the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. They have a weekly recap. And every week you can see that on an average, every single day, maybe 6 to 10 neighborhood incursions happen on a daily basis in the West Bank alone, and Gaza is fair game for anything. Air attacks, sea attacks, tanks and artillery coming in, border guards using children for target practice. This is real stuff. This is what's happening to these people.
Yes, it is, and it's used, by the way, for marketing purposes to illustrate that the weapons that the Israelis have developed can be used, and it is able to be researched and put down in statistical information to show the effectiveness of their weaponry, which they want to sell.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so. In the case of Israel, Bill, who knows how much America really gives Israel? I think a lot of it is under the table, but I think officially it's at least a few billion dollars a year, plus all kinds of special deals on interest-free loans. When they used to carry an interest rate, now they're so rock bottom, it's so cheap. But back when they used to have a legitimate interest rate, Israel could get interest-free loans. Some of them never had to be repaid. They would get extra add-ons. They get special technology and weapons, and it's one thing after another. And if Israel boxes something, then a friendly bribe will offer them something else, free this, free that, free whatever. And Israel gets more foreign aid, if you could call it foreign aid. It's mostly military. It's a little economic, but mostly military-related. Israel gets more than the rest of the world combined. This tiny country, 6 million people the size of Delaware.
Yep. Well, I was going to ask you, I don't know whether you've caught Franklin Lamb's article about preparing for a post-Israel Mideast.
Oh, I glanced at it. I'm aware of the article, Bill, and I glanced at it.
Okay, well, what he lists a number of things, which we've just been talking about, and you have listed so well, that if his report is true, and he points to an 82-page report that comes from a multiple group of intelligence and agencies that deal with the Mideast, everything from the CIA, all right, on. And the points that he makes in this article are, these are the issues that question the relationship of the United States to Israel as a friend and as a means to bring some kind of security to the citizens of the United States. In effect, what these items do is to actually demonstrate the opposite. First of all, what you just talked about, the day-to-day incursions of the occupation on Gaza and the West Bank result in a clandestine, untold savagery of a variety that can only be called meanness, that there's something missing in its need to be done, but nonetheless it is done, and it has a long-term penetrating impact on the minds of the people that are growing into adulthood in the areas that Palestine is suffering in. That's one. The leadership, joined with 700,000 settlers now, is out of touch with world opinion. That is to say, what we see in the savagery, and that's the only thing you can call it, that the settlers, who are now in numbers of significance, and they're not quiet, removed people, they are in-your-face people, and they attack with military weapons now, and they destroy and kill individuals, from lone shepherds to whole villages that are trying to make a peaceful march. And the world opinion is beginning to see that the IDF and the government doesn't have any control of these people. Indeed, it is being led in part by them because they need the votes to form a coalition government. The Labor Party is complicit with settlers, political and financial, and they control a great deal of the policy going through Israel, particularly how do we get rid of the existing Arab population, the Arab-Israeli, as they're called, in Israel itself, against, obviously, anything related to human rights. The Arab Spring has made millions of Arabs conscious of the illegality of Israel. In other words, it's not just a matter of what Israel has done in its occupation, but questioning of the legality of the state. They do not see it the way the United States does. They do not see it the way France and Britain see it. This was not a sympathy that came for a people being slaughtered themselves in Nazi Germany. And they need to respond to the lack of action taken by the West in that matter, because they were not involved themselves. And so they only see an imposed land taking over, and it's not even related to or restrained by the division made in the partition plan. They see it as a takeover of the entire land mass called Mandate Palestine, and so for them that becomes a very illegitimate action. And then the U.S. Is losing support throughout the Mideast, that we're sitting on it right now. This is the eruption that is taking place in northern Africa from Morocco to Turkey. This whole thing is an eruption not of a movie, but of the imposition by the West of a completely contradictory kind on, for 60 years, supporting dictators and imposing wills on the Arab people. Through the control of those dictators, from Mubarak to Saddam Hussein, you name it, every country had one. Now, going in and trying to undo those dictators because they see that events are changing the playing field, and now they move in and say, we want to help you with our democracy, and Hillary Clinton going over there and saying, why would people who were given their freedom by the United States now erupt against us? They do not view that as the reality at all. And then, of course, the gross Israeli interference in U.S. politics and the control of the Congress and of our policies that don't allow us to become friends with any country in the Mideast except Israel. And this kind of hypocrisy just stands out blatantly as we watch the Americans try to surround their embassies with walls the way Israel has tried to surround itself with walls to keep out the reality of a world that they have designed but which is no longer sustainable in the Mideast.
Well, I've talked about, I had several interviews on the violence going on in the region right now, Bill, and the movie and whoever was behind it. that was a spark. The issues were there, and it could have been any spark that could ignite them. And once it starts, it's like a brush fire in a wind, and it starts spreading, and it can turn into a forest fire. If I remember the number right, I think I saw something that violence had erupted in something like 17 countries. So it's gone beyond the Middle East. And there's real anger. I mean, America has been responsible for such horrific crimes. The last thing that America brings to any country is freedom or democratic values. It's simply its death, its destruction, its human misery, its exploitation, its theft of resources. It goes on and on. So it's happening in Iraq. The Iraq of two decades ago no longer exists. Afghanistan has been ravaged by so many countries for so many decades. You never get used to this kind of stuff going on, but Afghanistan was greatly ravaged long before the Soviets ever showed up. You could go back a century, beyond a century, and it's been going on. I mean, from one generation to another in that country, it's just a history of wars and violence and destruction, and America is the latest one to show up. But people are fighting back. I mean, these people, they want their country back. You can give them any name that you want, but the one name you shouldn't give them is to call them terrorists. They're not terrorists. It's their country. It's not ours. We don't have any right.
That's right.
The U.S. has no right to be there or in Iraq or in Libya, and America very much is in Iraq, 50,000 combat troops. I don't call that disengaging. Obama's fraudulent claim that America was pulling out 2 years ago, I think in August 2010. I mean, this just goes on and on and on. Libya was destroyed. Syria is being destroyed now. Iran is on the list to be destroyed. These people harm no one. Some of them are ruled by despots. Some of them, Syria is more autocratic than despotic. We need to take a short break, Bill, and we'll come back.
Okay.
We can pick this up. But these people have real grievances, and they have a right to fight back. And they got a pretext, and they're doing it. We should support them, not the violence, but we should support their right to live free. They have as much right as anybody else. We'll be right back. Welcome back on with William Cook, and we're talking about the Middle East and also Bill's new book called Decade of Deceit, 2002 to 2012. Bill, you could write a book going back over the six-plus decades, a separate one for each separate decade of deceit. I mean, it's one decade of deceit after another, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. It really is pretty disgusting and pathetic, and the fact that so few people who might make a difference know absolutely nothing about what's going on, it allows these horrors to go on endlessly. And innocent people, no different from our next-door neighbors, are suffering so badly. If this stuff was going on in our neighborhood, a fraction of it going on in our neighborhood that's been affecting these people for so many years, we simply wouldn't put up with it. We would react. We would do something to stop it. And we certainly would demand that the people running our cities and states and nation would do something to stop it. And if they didn't, then we would be raging in the streets.
That's correct. It's interesting to listen to the New York Times, for example, on these protests. They have a sentence that they highlight the unintended consequences of America's support of movements to overthrow those dictators. In other words, the unintended consequences is that America went in and somehow felt it was aiding the people in Tahrir Square to overthrow Mubarak. But there is no mention, either in the New York Times or in the reality of American communication, of the U.S. support for the dictators over those 40 years of Mubarak's reign, nor take any guilt for it and the consequences that are built in. Mark Levine has an article in Al Jazeera today where he refers to the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies of 2008. This precedes then the Arab Spring. And what he is pointing to is exactly what you just said, that we are engaged and have been for decades in the slaughter and destruction of the people across North Africa and in countries moving toward Southeast Asia. It is a frightening situation to realize that all of that is happening. And if we went back in history and looked at the Roman Empire crumbling, this is what we're witnessing, that the Roman Empire had attempted to take control of country after country after country and realized ultimately, when it had a few idiotic emperors in place, that they couldn't sustain it. And they hired mercenaries. And mercenaries do not fight to the end. They flee because their lives depend on it. We now have Blackwater as mercenaries in Iraq. We don't talk about them, but they're the ones that are there, and they're the most brutal, savage bunch of people you'd ever want to see in your life, and we protect them. That protection of the kind of military that's in place is not appreciated by the people themselves. And we then become, the American people, the object of that disdain and growing hatred. And that is a principal consequence of our past and the way in which we have behaved, especially the support, the unequivocal, unbreakable, absolutely to be the backbone of Israel is America. People do not lose any meaning of that because they realize that America has made Israeli savagery that you outlined so brilliantly there immune to any kind of punishment. They can go to no Human Rights Council, no international court, because America won't let it happen. This is a frightening thing that we have turned law out instead of trying to use it for justified purpose.
Again, it's so true, Bill, and it's so tragic, and it literally, it eats at me all the time to think of what's being done. And the other side of the coin for people in America, if you know, I wonder what can get under their skin to make them want to react. And aside from, you know, it's one thing to say your own welfare is being harmed. I think it's more important to spell out how. One way for certain is that every dollar spent on militarism, on waging these wars, on fighting the Pentagon, and more money is spent on militarism and imperialism and related belligerence than all other countries put together. At a time, America has no enemies except the ones it manufactures to fight the imperial wars that it does. And every dollar spent on that is one less dollar spent on needed things at home. And top of the list that gets hit hard, and it's been coming for years, it's been happening for years, going back especially since the Reagan years, and it's happening very, very much under George Bush. It's happened under Obama, and there's something called a sequester that will kick in beginning next year. For starters, it'll be taking $1.2 trillion out of mostly domestic spending and what they amount to mostly social spending, which means the things that people rely on, food stamps and all sorts of things. Medicare and Medicaid will be hit. I think they'll be backloaded rather than than initially, but they're scheduled to take major, major cuts. I think there'll be smaller ones to start off with, but it's a lot more than $1.2 trillion. We're talking trillions of dollars out of domestic spending will be cut, and the pretext is saying we have a fiscal cliff. We have a deficit crisis. Well, the deficit will go up year after year. It's because of all this money we're spending on the wrong things. We're either fighting wars or giving it to the Pentagon for other reasons, or we're handing it to corporations, or we're bailing out bankers. That's where America's resources are going. They're not going to help ordinary people who more than ever need this kind of help. Poverty is off the charts in America. The official number's way understated, but people are really suffering. There's a depression going on that ordinary people have been suffering through since 2008 when it really got going. It began in 2008. It began before that, but it really began in 2008, and it's been intensifying at the same time that the fat cats are making lots of money and the stock market is going up and everything is going for the super rich who don't need any more, but they're getting it anyway, and people are being murdered around the world. And this is what our government does. It doesn't matter whether it's Democrats or Republicans. What does it take to get people to react against this and actually get energized enough to put themselves on the line and try to stop it? That's what I ask.
You ask the question that everybody has to address. You know, one of the purposes of putting this book together was to try to concentrate on what I call transcendent values that pertain to humans anywhere, not just United States citizens or Israeli citizens or any other citizens of any other country, but rather how should people be behaving toward each other. And what we've seen throughout history is that the few who can garner enough of the resources and control will do exactly that. They really do not care about those that they must step on in order to gain their ends. But for me, it's a question of how do you ask about the people that haven't got the name, haven't got the estate on the hill, haven't got a power base where photographs of them or celebrities extolling them somehow make them a meaningful person. What about the ordinary, everyday person in life? And I wrote in Decade of Deceit a anniversary article for 9/11 called The Loneliness of the Falling Man. And I don't mean, you may remember that or not, but it's chapter 26 in the book. And I had sent it in on September 10th, 2011. And it's a reflection of a man who was caught by Alan Rowland with his camera. And he had a sequence of photographs of this fellow that was falling from the 102nd floor. And it struck me that here is an image of the person who is caught, unable to free himself, to escape, to put anything of his own effort to bear on the conditions which he has to endure, and the heat of those flames must have been so close that realizing he couldn't go up or down, he's faced with staying in, incinerating himself, or in quiet desperation leaping out of the window at the 102nd floor. And it occurred to me that in a way he is a representative figure. And I was hoping that using it might rouse in somebody a few concerns. I'll read a paragraph of that if you don't mind.
Well, go ahead, Bill.
The film highlights a photograph taken by Richard Drew. It is a shot no one wants to see or remember, yet it is unforgettable, catastrophic, a frozen image of human suffering, desperation, forlornness, loneliness in the last seconds of light and life before everlasting darkness. No image captures the appalling reality of this atrocity as this unknown figure falling to his doom, the victim of unknown forces that knew nothing of him, nothing of his family, nothing of his struggles to stay alive. alive, nothing of those left bereft of a father or son or nephew or grandfather, nothing of the sadness or happiness he brought to work that day, nothing of his desires or hopes or dreams caught now in the wind whipping through his shirt, tearing it from his body as he twisted helplessly in the vortex that funneled him to his death. That, it seems to me, is what we never concentrate on. Those that are in Baghdad on the 20th of March, when we unleashed untold numbers of weapons on a city that had no defense. We had taken it out over a 12-year period of sanctions. So here they were, caught in a city beneath which the bombs were simply coming in untold numbers. And no one in America saw it, because we were given a little bit of a green light display of firecrackers going off over the city. And the human element had been liposuctioned out. Our news couldn't cover it. It did nothing to allow people to realize we are slaughtering people there. And one of those that was slaughtered is a kid named Ali Abbas. And his name I wrote about in another piece that's it's actually in an earlier book. It's in this one, too, called The Star-Crossed Lives of Ali Abbas and Donald Rumsfeld. And what I attempted to do there was to present Ali being born at a point in time that happened to coincide when he was 9 years old, with Donald Rumsfeld deciding on shock and awe that he was going to bring to the Saddam Hussein such a pulverizing slaughter of the capital city that he would immediately give up, and the people in Iraq would come out with flowers and welcome the invaders as heroes. Never thinking of Ali Abbas or any other kid who happened to be living at that time. And Ali Abbas woke up in the wee hours of the morning with the screaming of missiles that tore into his house. And he heard his grandmother's voice. And when she woke him, he had no arms and no legs, and he was burned over 60% of his body. And now he was an orphan. But Donald Rumsfeld never knew this, or never even cared to find out about it, or to be concerned and feel that maybe he had done something he shouldn't do. But it is that kind of attitude that when you set forward an Ayn Rand desire to get your objective, you will kill off and slaughter and attain whatever you must, because that is your drive. That's the desires that propel us forward. That is sad, but that is the mentality of those who are in control, it seems to me.
Bill, it sure is. It sure is. They literally don't think at all about the human cost of what they're doing, except in one respect, Bill, that civilians are every bit as much a legitimate target as combatants. There either is no distinction, or sometimes civilians are literally targeted for strategic purposes. It's shocking. One of the best examples of the sanctions in the 1990s against the Iraqis, where they were the ones who were harmed, where maybe 1.5 million of them died because of these
yes.
sanctions. I mean, these targeted innocent civilians and children more than anybody else. So you have to wonder what goes through the minds of a militarist or an imperialist, that this is part of their strategy. And Israel gave it a name, Bill. Remember the 2006 Lebanon war, they destroyed a town called if I can pronounce it right, Dahiya, Lebanon, and they gave it a name, and they gave it a Dahiya doctrine or a Dahiya strategy, and Israel considers targeting civilians more than just fair game. It's part of its strategy when it goes to war. It literally wants to go after civilians if they are in an area, meaning a country that Israel goes to war with, whether it's Gaza or Lebanon or whatever, then civilians are legitimate targets and they're killed. It happened in Lebanon in 2006. It happened in Gaza, the Castle-led war, 2008-2009. In any future war Israel fights, and I quoted generals, Israeli generals, coming out in plain English, well, translated into English, I guess, saying that this is the way Israel will fight its wars. They will go after civilian targets, civilian villages and homes and so on, every bit as much as military ones, and under international law, leaders to say, these are war crimes.
That's right, but we don't bring Israel before the courts. We don't allow them to do that. It's not we, the American people. It is we, the government of the United States, and it has been going on for these 63 years, including Truman at the very beginning. The slaughter that occurred between November of 47 and May 15th of 48 is a tale of 418 towns and villages where the people were massacred and thrust out of their own country. And along with that, the plunder and the rape of the people that were there. This has been something that has been the process of Israeli terrorism. It happened before the partition plan of 47, when they were and declared war in words that they uttered, that I've got in files here from Sir Richard Catling's secret file in the Rhodes House Library. We do not intend to leave a live Arab in this land. This is their way of behaving, and it does not comport, as far as I can tell, with the usual process of human discourse, which we, as a nation, declared to be the base of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, which then became the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations. And we, of all nations, should be upholding it, but we do not. And how do we change the control of our Congress that is in place at the present time, when you can command 100 votes of the Senate without question in support of the bombing and the invasion of Gaza in 2008-9, when you can support the deliberate killing on the Marmara, and go against international consensus that this should not be allowed. But we do it through our Congress, and our Congress then puts on us, as citizens of this country, the responsibility for those crimes. And that's why I'm writing. I do not want to be blamed. I do not want to be seen. I don't want America to be seen as that kind of country. To me, if you love the country, you object to what we're doing. There's no other alternative.
Again, so true, Bill, and it's really shocking. I can remember more than once quoting the late Edward Said saying, in a matter of hours, the Israeli lobby could bring together the entire Senate, 100 senators, to vote for Israel on virtually anything. Absolutely shocking. You get senators, of course, represent a whole state, so they are a bit more concerned about representing Israel than congressmen, but virtually the entire House of Representatives could be brought together. You get a few outliers, but not very many, maybe people who happen to be in districts where people don't really care about Israel one way or another, but even they will get targeted, like Cynthia McKinney, who twice was elected to Congress from a district in Georgia, and twice the Israeli lobby supported a candidate with a lot of money and defeated her and got her out of the Congress. But she was treated mercilessly, I think, by her fellow representatives. And she's been on this program a couple of times. And we shared a book together. She edited a book on Libya, and I contributed a couple of chapters to it. And we discussed it on this program some weeks back. But she knows full well how, even as a member of Congress, you can be persecuted for going up against Israel. Who ever heard of anything like that? And what is she doing? She exposed legitimate crimes.
Yes, and that's the problem. And it seems to me, you know, that you represent, and I must thank you for it, being a Jew yourself, a full understanding of the reality of what the Jewish people always represented to me when I was growing up, and which I do not understand at the present time. The book that you wrote the preface for, this Decade of Deceit, begins in chapter one with an article from 2002, The Ghosts of Terezin. And I had been over in Prague, and I went to Terezin at that time. And I went through the prison and to the upper stories of into the attic, and there are children's pictures depicted there of those that were kept in the Terezin prison and their parents there as they waited for the trains to take them to all the other places where the crematoriums existed. And it seems to me that that is a reflection that if you look back at it and said to yourself, this is what was happening to my people, that you wouldn't be able to to anyone else. And the article ends with a poem called The Ghosts of Terezin. And the purpose of that was to try to put together an understanding that this reality, that there are people that are suffering, and that's the issue. People are suffering. Not that this people, that people, some labeled people, but rather people are suffering, and if we don't attend to it, we are the cause in one way or another of complicitness in that kind of slaughter.
We sure are, Bill. We're nearly out of time. I'll mention very briefly, I've only been to Europe once, but I was in Germany for most of the time, and I was in Munich, and I took a side trip. It was so close by. I went to Dachau, and I I picked a good day to go. It was bitter cold, and that was a good day to feel some of the discomfort of the people who died there, living under miserable conditions and then died. And I literally saw the ovens. I think the buildings that were up were rebuilt, replicas of the ones that existed. But I suspect that the ovens were real, and I stood right in front of them, just 5 feet in front of those ovens, and just the thought of it today gives me the chills. This is what went on. Israel doesn't have ovens, but they have their own version of genocide. It's slow motion. Hitler was mass production. Israel is slow motion. Hitler had 12 years. Israel has been going on for over six decades. But all the rest that goes on throughout the region and other parts of the world, these are horrors. I mean, we're talking about human beings, and again, Bill, we both agree. I happen to be Jewish, but it doesn't matter. I could be anything. I mean, we're all human beings. We're all the same. It doesn't matter what God we pray to or what party we vote for. I mean, we're people. We're part of the human species, the human race. Right. We should all respect each other, because what happens to anybody anyplace could happen to us. A quick final word, Bill.
Well, I wanted to thank you for that preface, and I appreciate the chance to at least mention the book on your show. My concern, obviously, in putting it together was to show the power of polemics can achieve as a form of writing, and that is to bring an issue of universal significance to bear on actions of a moment. And that, in fact, is what these articles are. None of the articles that I dealt with in terms of a news kind of base are in here. These are the articles that deal with something larger than that of the human experience and human nature. And I hope it gets some representation out there and is accepted and understood.
Bill,
and thank you very much.
Bill, your book moved me very much, Decade of the Sea, 2002-2012. It's a treasure trove of vital information. The real thing that people need to know. I recommend it so strongly. It was an honor for me, Bill, to write the preface to it. It was a special moment for me, but the book itself really stands out. And, Bill, you've been a special guest today. I thank you so much for coming on.
I appreciate it, and best to all of your listeners.
And I'll just remind them that, of course, every weekend, Saturday and Sunday, we're on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We're on Fridays now on New Day at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.